We recognize with appreciation every person in this company of the people of God. The preacher tonight is the Reverend Dr. Andrew D. Lester. Dr. Lester is a native of Florida. He earned the Bachelor of Arts degree at Mississippi College, the Bachelor of Divinity degree, and the Doctor of Theology degree at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary at Louisville, Kentucky. He has served as a pastor, as a counselor, as special instructor in psychology of religion at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. At the present time, he is director of the Department of Pastoral Care and the School of Pastoral Care at the Baptist Hospital in Winston-Salem. He is also a member of the instructional staff of this seminary. He is held in high regard by his students and by his colleagues. It is a privilege to welcome him to this chapel and to present him as a preacher on this occasion. After the anthem, Dr. Lester will speak.
It is an honor to be referred to as the preacher for this occasion, because it's quite an honor, as you can imagine, to stand before this group of people and to be charged with the responsibility of saying something that is important. It gives me also an opportunity, before sharing some of my thoughts with you, to express my deepest gratitude and appreciation to the administration and the faculty of this seminary for allowing me, at least on a part-time basis, to be a colleague of theirs and to participate with them in theological education. It would be impossible for me to express to them how much it has meant to me this year to be back in the classroom and to be teaching again in an academic setting. The stimulation which I have already received, and particularly the support which I received from this group of people, administration and faculty, has been very meaningful. I look forward to, in years to come, to know even more of them at the depth which I have been able to know a few of them. But my great appreciation for that. My anxiety about tonight and what I would like to say is something that the students that took my course this last semester would appreciate knowing at least. For I'm sure they wondered as I talked about anxiety in the classroom if indeed and in fact that strange dynamic was ever part of my own experience. This gives me a chance to assure you that it does. My anxiety, if it could be put on a graph, I was able to keep at minimum through vacation time, which ended last Saturday. And then on Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, it began to be quite acute, as the scholarly part of me wanted to think of something to say that would be definitive. The needs for acceptance and recognition made me want to say something profound and meaningful. All of those things went through my mind, and my anxiety got high until I tried to remember what had been said at the baccalaureate addresses which I had attended in my years, numbering at least six that I can remember. It was quite enlightening to know that I not only did not remember anything that had been said, I couldn't even remember who had said it. So my anxiety went down until I came to the campus on Tuesday to pass out some grades and see students, and people kept saying, "Andy, we're looking forward to Thursday night. Want to know what you're going to say." And a lot of people said that, and I began to think, there's people here that are taking this very seriously, and my anxiety went up again and really was quite high until about an hour and a half ago, when John Durham, in a masterful way, gave a very humorous and insightful speech to the senior banquet, and was able to put in perspective for us many things that we take with too much ultimacy, one of them being the messages that are given during baccalaureate and commencement banquet types of experiences. And John put me so much at ease that I was really for a while there not even caring how the night went off. And but there was no way that I could continue to have that attitude after watching everyone get dressed and being in a line and marching over here, and the ultimacy of it began to weigh again. And the last straw was when I looked at the program and noticed that someone in anticipation had chosen to follow the sermon tonight with the hymn, "Let There Be Light." When any of us chooses to speak, we speak of necessity from within our own context. My context is that of a pastoral counselor and a clinical theological educator. It is from that context which I would share some thoughts with you tonight. When I heard that the student body, or some group of them, had asked the faculty some month ago, "What kinds of things would you say to graduating seniors or to theological students if it were the last thing you could tell them?" I was intrigued by that question, and as I struggled to think of something that I could talk about tonight, I went back to the first response I had to that question and picked up on the subject which at that time came to my mind. Because what I would say would not be only on behalf of myself, but I would like very much to try and be an advocate for the average church member. And I would label my subject tonight, Up with Humanness. Many times during the button craze, I wanted to get some button maker to make me a button that said, Up with Humanness. And I would like to remind you tonight and speak on behalf of those people who sit in my office day to day and week to week as counselees, the large majority of whom are church members. And perhaps also speak on behalf of those many ministers that come through the School of Pastoral Care as they begin to find more about their own humanness. People in our day and time have a heavy load to carry. All of us are in that boat. And it is to my sadness that occasionally we as ministers and the church as the church makes that burden heavier rather than lighter. And my concern tonight is to speak somewhat to that point. The people that sit in my office are the same people that you see in your church every day, or every Sunday at least, and many times during the week. They're respectable people. They're people that think a lot of God. They're people that support your church. They're your leaders. But they also have many pains and many hurts and many burdens. I would like to say tonight that one of the ways that we as a church and as ministers could help these people with their burdens is to be and have more of an emphasis on the humanness which the gospel of Jesus Christ, at least in my opinion, would have us to take very seriously. So many times we teach people and have people experience the transcendence of God, God the Almighty, the Omnipotent, the Omniscient. We have them experience Jesus Christ in His divinity. And I would think that sometimes we neglect to be able to communicate to our people, and indeed accept for ourselves, that Jesus was also human. Exhibit A would be for me, 3 weeks ago at an interdenominational pastors' conference in Miami, Florida. I sat and listened to the other speaker as he gave what I consider to be a classic put-down of humanness. His point was that the word vessel in the New Testament was a word that he wished the New Testament writers had not used because the vessel has a hole only at the top, and he went on to express his concern that a vessel had to be full before there was any spillage. And therefore, if the Christian is a vessel and God works in him, God has to fill him up before he can mean something to other people. And he went on to suggest that the better analogy that the New Testament writer should have used was to suggest that we be a pipe that has a hole at either end so that whatever is put into us immediately goes out without touching us. And I sat there and fantasized, you know, about the Christian then, at least in this speaker's idea, should approach his or her own humanness by moving it out of the way so we could make a big hole through us where there was nothing, so that when God pours the Spirit of Christ through us, it just runs out the other end. And I thought to myself, the main point of that is that somehow our humanness gets in God's way. That really God would be better off if humanness didn't exist and he could move somehow straight toward other people without having to be bothered with you and I. And there are stacks of devotional literature as high as this steeple that imply all through it that somehow the better Christians are those who sacrifice the self, who kill the I, who starve the ego, and those Christians who forget themselves, who forget their own needs, who pay no attention to their own hurts, those are the greater Christians, the Christians that God can work through better than any others. I would like to suggest that that is an inappropriate response to the Christian gospel, and would like to challenge it briefly on at least 3 points. First of all, I would like to challenge that type of thought, the type of thought that would suggest our humanness is unimportant and really in God's way, and that God taints himself, so to speak, by getting involved with our humanness. That thought I want to challenge in 3 ways. First of all, by referring to what I consider to be the mainstream of our Christian thought about the doctrine of creation. It's my understanding that the Christian faith suggests that when God created, as the Hebrew writer said, he looked around and saw that it was good. My feeling is that God, when he created, did so purposefully, and that he did so in such a way that he was pleased with it. And I take very seriously when the Hebrew writer says that God looked around and saw that it was good. And yet the way some people suggest that Christians ought to feel about at least their own existence, their humanness, would suggest to me that the doctrine of creation would say that God kind of made a mistake when he got to man. As if God spoke and man appeared and God had to say, "Oh my Lord," or "Oops," and then spent the rest of time trying to fix it. It's almost as if a cartoon character, sometimes, you know, they portray a kind of bumbling wizard who speaks to bring something into creation, and he bumbled the words and the wrong thing appeared and he has to live with it. Well, my feeling is that however we explain and deal with creation, that one of the truths of it is that God created purposefully, knowledgeably, and that what he got was what he wanted. Now, I realize on the side here that we have to deal with what we learn about as the fall of man. And I would suggest that whatever the fall of man means to you, hopefully that it has something to say about man's coming of age, about man learning about his responsibility, about man learning how heavy freedom was, and about man's first experience when he acted freely in a wrong way. But whatever you believe about the fall of man, certainly historical Christian faith does not believe that the fall of man equals humanness became evil or totally depraved or in some way abominable to God. Certainly the goodness that God saw in the beginning of his creation is still the goodness that God feels about you and I today. The doctrine of creation, I think, would have us to know and remember that humanness is okay. Secondly, I would like to challenge the idea that humanness is kind of a two strikes against us by referring something or somewhat to our doctrine of incarnation. For don't we as a Christian people put much weight on the fact that God became flesh to become among us, become one of us in a sense? Isn't it true in our belief that God revealed himself definitively in the personhood, in the humanness of Jesus Christ? If God chose humanness in which to reveal himself, can we treat it any less than he did? And could it be that the way that Jesus became the Son of Man included the fact that he allowed his humanness to be so filled with godness that he became both fully God and fully man? Could there even have been an incarnation unless the incarnate one was fully human and had made the most of his humanness? Indeed, if Jesus had chosen to deny his humanness, to suppress it, to do away with it, to not like it, he would not have been the total Son of God. However we go about trying to think of fully God and fully man, certainly to me it must include believing that Jesus somehow fulfilled humanness and sets an example for us of what that humanness is. I wonder if the temptations of Jesus in the wilderness could not be explained, not definitively, obviously, there's so many meanings in it, but one of the meanings it carries to me is that Jesus did have the opportunity to choose to lay down his humanness and let his godness carry the day by turning these stones into bread and by going up to the top of the temple and jumping off and letting the angels keep him from dashing himself to pieces. But Jesus chose against the temptations. It was not one thing he was doing in that, choosing to continue to reveal himself through his humanness. The third challenge I would issue to the concept that humanness is bad is this. From the standpoint of both psychology and theology, it is impossible for a person to choose to give up their humanness. It is impossible for a person to choose to give up their humanness. For we do not have it in our power to become something else. It is true that man can warp his humanness, but he cannot give it up. How many of us are tempted to become little angels or little spirits? Or how many of us are tempted to somehow let what we consider to be our godness take over? But when a man attempts, or a woman, to give up, suppress, deny their humanness, they only succeed in warping it. And the end product is a terrible thing. Only one example might suffice at this point, and that is particularly relevant to us as ministers. How easy it is for us as ministers, caught up in the popular idea that we have to conquer our humanness, get so caught up in it that we really get carried away with ourselves and come to the point sometimes when we think we have conquered it, and that now God so infuses us with himself that we've almost ascended to the right hand of God and learned their great wisdom and truth. And of course, it's my understanding that that seat has been filled. But when we do that, how easy it is then to become pious and bombastic, to be a I have all the answers minister, who sees himself as being in a new realm of humanity, kind of a transhuman or beyond human realm, and then sees that his responsibility is to bring humans out of humanity to himself. To me, the picture that the New Testament gives us is one in which a part of God's will, and who of us understands it fully, but I think that certainly a part of God's will is that you and I be able to find full humanity, that we would fill up our humanness, that we would be able to seek out an abundant life, and that that is good. Now, if you would buy my idea about up with humanness, if what I have said very briefly and very non-definitively makes sense to you, how can you and I take seriously the tremendous need of the people that we minister to and the needs that we find within ourselves to be more fully human, to follow Christ's example in being able to expand and to fill up and be a vessel so that God can come within us and we can actually be in Christ, be filled up and be fully human and be a witness of what God has done within us? How can we go about that? Teaching, of course, becomes very important. How nice it would be to hear sermons on Christ-likeness that would not only suggest that Christ-likeness means being God-like, which is kind of a strange concept and is difficult for us to wash theologically, but how nice it would be to hear more sermons on what Christ-likeness means if we think of Christ and his humanness, so that then becoming Christ-like, as we think about it as Christians, would mean not only following Christ's examples in the way that we think of his godness, but yes, then we could identify with his humanness. Maybe we too would feel free to grieve as strongly as he grieved, to confront as strongly as he confronted, to celebrate as much as he celebrated, to take time for little children, to be patient with the demoniacs, and all of those other things in which Jesus filled his humanness. I would like to suggest, and I will not be long at it, four ways in which I would like for us to consider and to take seriously the need for more humanness. First of all, I would like to remind us that the gospel of Jesus Christ is certainly a gospel of freedom and liberation, not a gospel in which is the opposite of this, that we should not pay attention to those who would believe that the gospel is one that puts down, ties down, who puts under wraps and suppresses and controls, but that the gospel of Jesus Christ is supposed to liberate us and to make us free. We're able to transcend, in a sense, ourselves. One of you that's here tonight told me in a casual conversation within the last week or two that you were weighed down so heavily as a child and particularly as a teenager by the need to be perfect. And in your home and in your community, being perfect meant meeting all of the obligations and expectations of a particular group of people about what a ministerial student should be. What a terrible, stifling burden that trying to be perfect and live up to those kinds of demands and expectations becomes to all of us. If the gospel is one of freedom, we must be able to enjoy our humanness and to celebrate even more what it means to be a creature of God. Freedom and liberation. And I'll come back and overlap to that as I move along. But let me move to the second concern I have, and that is that the gospel of love, this Christian gospel that we preach, must include a healthy concept of self-love. Now, self-love becomes identified in our mind from early on with selfishness and pride. And yet selfishness and pride are not related to self-love because they grow out of self-dislike, not of self-love. But a healthy self-love in which we can learn to give value to ourselves, to consider ourselves people of worth if for no other reason, that God loves us. Well, what God loves certainly becomes lovable. A nursing student who's a good friend of mine back in Winston-Salem would perhaps illustrate the kind of concern that I have. She grew up in a home with an alcoholic mother and a weak and very passive father. Her whole life has been one of verbal and physical abuse. The result of that, or at least one aspect of the result of that, is that she feels so poorly about herself. She cannot perceive that she is someone that anyone else could like. The only way she perceives that she's lovable is when she works hard enough and does something well enough that then she hopes other people would say, "Well done." But to feel lovable to another person is something that is very difficult for her to grasp. And the gospel of Jesus Christ, with its message of acceptance, of grace, of love, is trying to mean to her that she's okay. That for her to be human is all right. That for her to assert herself is okay. And sadly to say, her own church and some of the other Christian adults around have made her feel somehow that she owes everything to others and is unable to take any love into herself. But the gospel of love must include a healthy concept of self-love. Thirdly, I would like to remind you, at least in my feelings about the Christian faith, is that the gospel of love is one which proclaims and holds up for people the truth expressed in 1 John, that mature, complete love throws out fear. Throws it right out the door, I believe is the meaning of that word, because fear is related to punishment. And my, how many people that are Christian are afraid. Afraid of so many things that it wouldn't be time to shake a stick at all of them. The fear of vulnerability. Christians who are so afraid and caught up in the Puritan concept of self-sufficiency and perfectionism that they are unable to reveal their needs to other people. So afraid to share and confess shortcomings, to cry out for help, to lean on another person, to be dependent. They feel that this indicates a lack of faith. And so it is that so many people are afraid of just vulnerability. People are so afraid of emotions. Christians have long